Hi, I'm Claire Edwards, and I'm the percussionist and artistic director of Sydney's new music group, Ensemble Offspring. The Offcast is a new podcast from Ensemble Offspring, where I'll be chatting to the musical mavericks, the pioneers, the ones who were often perceived as the outcasts in the world of classical music as they grew and blossomed. But as professionals, it is these people who are the innovators and the ones who are creating much needed change and diversity for our musical landscape. And today I would like to welcome the new CEO of the Australian Music Centre, Catherine Harrity. Welcome, Kath.
Thank you so much for having me. What a beautiful introduction.
Yeah, well, it's actually, I've been chatting to some amazing people, and even if no one listens to this podcast, it's been really fun for me, so that's all good.
Sounds brilliant. I'm looking forward to listening to all the others.
Yeah, some really, really inspiring guests, I have to say. As you are, and I'm just looking forward to getting to know you a bit better through this little chat. I thought, as I mentioned to you when we tried to organise our first chat probably a couple of months ago now, and this is probably, I would say, the most rescheduled Zoom that has ever been in the history of the universe.
Incredible.
I said that, you know, I think as well as selfishly, I wanted to get to know you, but I felt like I could do, or we at Ensemble Offspring could do a bit of a service to the whole community and have a chat to you that would be a public chat and other people could get to know you too, because I'm sure lots of people, since you started 5.5 months ago as a CEO, it's been a tricky time with all the lockdowns and we weren't able to meet you at the Art Music Awards or any time in person if we weren't living in Melbourne.
No.
So, yes, this is nice.
It's been a challenging time. There's no doubt about it. It's definitely been an interesting time to start this role.
There's a mixture of that, and there's also the stepping into the shoes of John Davis, who was in the role for, was it almost 20 years? I don't know, but it was a long time.
35, I think.
35, wow, amazing. I guess I was interested to know, in terms of informing your role, I know John wasn't a trained musician, but did you ever study a musical instrument? Is it something that, I know you've been in music for a long time and you studied communication, so you didn't study music per se, but what sort of got you from doing a communications degree into the music industry?
I always had a passion for music, and particularly Australian music. And when I was growing up, Australian music was extraordinarily valued. It was in a time where we had, you know, contemporary musicians like In Excess and Midnight Oil and all these huge popular music artists that were really revered and held up in our culture to be very important. And for me, that just it stoked a fire in me. I had just an absolute passion for music and Australian music, and it's always been something that I've been a bit of a train spotter about as well. So really gone deep.
But you don't play yourself.
I have played, yeah, I have actually. Strangely enough, I have played, and not very well, but I can. So I've played clarinet and violin. I had a go at guitar, but I sang as well for a long time. So
did you have a band?
No, never got that far. Never felt confident enough. And performing for me was always an area of the huge challenge. I have an enormous respect for performers. I think it's a huge, huge thing to step out on a stage in front of a large group of people and really expose yourself in that way. You're showing a vulnerability that, to me, is, you know, a huge risk.
I think you are, but I think there's also, It's like a learned skill, like lots of skills that you can learn.
Mm.
And through, I mean, I guess you have to be set up to do it in the first place or want to or have some sort of basic skill in the first place. Although I know a lot of people who have overcome performance anxiety as well, like a lot of professionals.
Mm.
I was lucky enough to not ever have that seriously as a percussionist. I did actually as a pianist when I was a bit younger. But so I know I have the capacity to have performance anxiety, but interestingly, just through the doing of it over the last 20 years, it's amazing how comfortable you can feel doing something that you are so used to doing, you know, mm. and how good you can get at it also in terms of speaking on stage and making the audience feel comfortable and going between that mode and playing, not needing that time to change headspace and stuff. It's definitely a skill, but for me personally, I feel like most people could probably do it if they just got through that initial kind of anxiety.
Yeah, and I've got to say, I think I worked out pretty early on that working with musicians, composers, creators, for me, was my superpower. That was where I really felt comfortable. It was facilitating a vision, helping pave the way for somebody to create.
Yeah, and of course we need those people as well.
Mm, yeah.
Very much yeah. so.
But as a hobby and as something that, you know, I really enjoy doing, I think singing would still be up there for me.
Do you sing in choirs?
I used to, yeah. I used to sing in choirs and madrigal groups, yeah.
So, did you get involved in the ABC's latest little choral thing that Katie Noonan wrote?
No, but I saw it. And what an incredible initiative. Again, you know, that sort of crowdsourced community, you know, everybody in, accessible feeling of
choirs
being.
Choirs are amazing for that. Like, so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, there's something incredible about getting together with a large group of people and having that sort of collective experience.
Yeah.
It's really,
I wish,
really special.
My mum's just retired and I wish she would join a choir. And I know if I suggested it, she'd be like, I can't read music, I can't sing, don't be stupid, Claire. But actually, I saw Brendan Joyce from Camerata in Brisbane posted a little cute video of his dad singing in a choir at the shopping mall the other day. And I was
gorgeous.
Like, and he said he couldn't read music before. And I was just like, oh, so liberating, so awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, and that feeling that, you know, music is for all. I love that, and I love the way that it can completely turn your day on its head. You can, you can really, you know, feel through music. It can change the way you approach your day. Just by, you know, listening to one piece can absolutely transform a moment. And that's super important to me. And hence, you know, from a very early age, just being really connected in with music and really feeling like, as a music appreciator, that it was a real passion for me. And then had the opportunity from there to actually get involved in music. And you know, I did that through volunteering at Triple R for some years, and then moving on from that, being employed in a record label. Warner Music was my first real music gig. So for me, bringing some of those skill set from the popular music space over to this space, I think that there are certain things that can be repurposed. I think the idea of being able to run your own career on your terms, being able to understand how to potentially get your compositions or your music out there on a broader scale, to me it seems that there's this real sort of barrier in art, not all art music, but definitely within the contemporary classical realm, where you create a composition it's performed or premiered, and then it stops about there. There doesn't seem to be a life for it past that point. But to me, there's got to be options and avenues for that to have a life. It seems sad to me that this creation that somebody pours so much time and effort and love into only has a very small lifespan.
Yes. Well, wait, so I've got so many things I want to ask you or tell you.
Yeah,
so
please.
With Ensemble Offspring, that's kind of what we live for, like trying to make sure it is more than that, you know.
Yeah.
Not all music deserves or is appropriate to be more than that, but a lot of it is. And we just finished our Hatched Academy summer school for 2021. And, you know, if you would see just the amount of passion and energy all of us performers put into feeding back to the composers, making sure they understand, making sure their scores are reflecting what we do in that performance. And then it doesn't stop there, of course. Like it has to be kind of helping them disseminating it, putting it on a list on our website, making sure the recordings are, you know, available for the world to see. Yes. And I think that's where a lot of emerging composers especially get stuck, that they don't have that documentation at the high level. And so that's what I hear from them anyway. That, yeah, it's very tricky for them to get more opportunities and keep climbing the ladder unless they have that early on. So I guess that's what we do try to offer with Hatched Academy. And there are other organisations, not just ours, who do similar things. But
and that's a wonderful initiative too, Claire, because I have been following Hatched, and it those kind of programs are just incredible. And to me, being able to really, like, to scaffold, to support young composers and young artists through, you know, every step of their career, but also give them avenues or give them opportunity to be able to have as much of a life for their compositions or their music as possible. And that to me feels really, really important. And I guess, you know, that the Peggy Glanville Hicks address that we did just recently with Zella Margosian and C. Ahmed and Brie Van Reich, that was incredible, because within that conversation there was a lot of discussion and talk around this idea of the punk ethos. And I love that. I love the synergy between that attitude, not the music per se, but, yeah, the music, but the attitude, that punk attitude applied to every form of music, that idea that there are no rules, that you can create, you can make, you can break, you can recreate the rules.
And, you know, now more than ever because of the internet, that in a way this is a really interesting time for that reason, but I'm interested to know what you think about this whole issue around streaming and the lack of money for popular artists, let alone unpopular artists like us. How, you know, because we talked a lot in Hatch Summer School, we had industry sessions and we would talk a lot about, like, different way, like different avenues to fund your music making and your career, right? So we talked a lot about private philanthropy, which is not something that most individual composers tend to have thought about before. We talked about what sort of government grants you should go for or not, because otherwise you're just pouring your time into kind of random shooting into the air, and probably it's going to be random what comes back. But we didn't talk so much about money that could come from streaming or Spotify or Apple Music or whatever. And I do personally struggle with that because, you know, Ensemble Offspring, we have a lot of recordings, and I do too. And, you know, it's unbelievably depressing when you get your, I mean, all we get money from is when our recordings go on ABC compilation albums, and it's literally like $7 for half a year kind of thing. And it's like, no, there is no way in our world, as far as I can see, anyone is currently making money from that unless their piece gets picked up for an ad or something.
I was going to say there's that sync and licensing opportunity, which I think that there is a lot of sync and licensing opportunity actually for composition in this space.
Yeah,
this
I think we don't understand well enough how it works. Can you explain how it works?
Yeah, look, it does help when you have, you know, either independent sync experts and or publishers involved. But I do think that there's something for us here, and it's something I want to explore a little bit more. Maybe it's something we can explore together, Claire, this year. But this idea of being able to, you know, pitch your music out for both placement in advertisements, placement in television, placement in film.
Yeah.
I think that there are opportunities there, and particularly for these genres of music.
Yeah, definitely. Does APRA act as a medium with that sort of thing? I mean, how would you find the people who you pitch to? I mean, I don't know, and I'm sure most of my colleagues don't have those sorts of contacts.
No, and usually there would be people in definitely in the larger scale publishing companies in Australia that would have people that are specifically devoted to this and these kind of relationships. So these kind of relationships that they've developed probably over years with, say, advertising agencies and creatives and directors. But they're also relationships that you can actually cultivate yourself, but it takes time, and it also takes a little bit of effort, and you have to be able to commit to that. But what I hope that we can do at the AMC through this year is be able to do a series of capacity building Zoom drop-ins with people like this, who I've had experiences with in the popular music space, who can bring that expertise potentially over to this space and maybe make connections. For me, it's not just about making the connections in the art music community with people that potentially work in this other space, but it's for people in this other space to understand what's going on here in the art music community, because they don't understand most of the time. There is some crossover. And I do see it. There are certain artists that have crossed over very, very nicely. And I think, you know, obviously Brie is one of them. Sia is another one that have had experiences in the popular music space and have brought some of that attitude and that approach, I think, into the work that they do here. But I don't think the two areas or the two worlds should be mutually exclusive. I think that they should actually be taking the best bits or the bits that we want out of both. There's a certain level of respect, I think, that you know, we need to have for everybody creating Australian music, whether they come from a popular music space, an art music space, or another space within, you know, within the ecosystem.
I'm very interested to see how networks could be created, because I think in a way that's what it is that has to happen. I mean, you wouldn't imagine how many times we might play a concert or some new board members just joined or something and they say, oh, I just had this great idea, like you could make heaps of money selling your music to movies. And I'm like, okay, there are so many issues here, one of which is that we're just playing the music, like we didn't write it. So we're not going to make the money, which is fine. Like, we're going to say the composers are going to make money, great. But also,
you will if you've played it.
Really?
Because there's two copyrights. There's the composer, the right that the composer or the writer has in the work, and then there's the rights, the master rights, which is the recording rights, which you have a part of.
And it's true. And the problem is that the ABC, not to muddy the name of the ABC, but I think they have muddied the waters for most of us, because if you ever recorded something, or if the ABC ever recorded something that you played live, there's something in that contract that means that they own it and they don't have to pay anything. I think someone told me it got set up many years ago under John Crawford. And so, for example, my recording of Ian Grandage's concerto, which gets played every single day at 2 o'clock on the ABC, Ian and I get nothing from it, nothing. And it's just one of those things that you just, and we also wouldn't know that it was being used unless we happened to catch it on the radio. Ian didn't even know. So I don't know. There's just something weird about that.
It's so like, it's your,
and so that's you, why we you all
played
give up. It.
You played that you're yeah. the performer and yeah. Ian, the wonderful Iggy,
yeah.
composed it.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have the rights to that composition
apparently
anymore.
Not. Well, no, he doesn't have the rights to that. Perform that recording by the ABC because the ABC own it.
But he'd have his rights in the composition.
Mm.
You might have signed over the actual recording, the master right. Mm. And this is what's really interesting about all of this. And it is interesting that you should bring the ABC up because those I've had some interesting conversations as well with various others in the art music community who have discussed the nature of those agreements and those contracts. And I do think that there are things that, you can preserve. And I'm assuming in that particular instance, in that particular piece that you're talking about, it was released by them as a label?
No, it's just a live recording that they made, and WASO, Western Australian Symphony Orchestra,
would have been the
contract.
Okay, yeah, now I'm
And
following.
Then there would have been something in my contract as a soloist that was signing away the rights so that WASO could have signed away the rights to the ABC, I guess.
Yes, and I think
and
this
the composer
has...
doesn't even have a contract, right?
Yeah, and my instance. Understanding of that situation, because I'm just starting to delve into this a little bit more, and this is a really interesting area for me because at the heart of things, that barriers, barriers for actual, I guess, potential to, either make money from a composition or be able to utilise that performance in a way that could actually benefit the people who actually played on it or the person who wrote it. For me, there are barriers, and I'm starting to see what those barriers are the more I talk to people and the more I listen. Mm. And I see that is what you've just talked about is one of the barriers. So
yes, because let's be honest, if
yes.
the ABC didn't have that rule in place, they're a government-funded, really under-resourced organisation, mm-hmm. and they wouldn't choose that piece to play every day if they did have to pay a lot of money. They would make something up that was free or make something themselves in-house, I guess.
And I'm
you
assuming,
know what I mean?
Like yeah, that, and I'm
that
assuming
comes into
that
because there isn't money there.
Yeah, and I'm assuming that Ian has registered those compositions with APRA AMCOS, and I'm assuming that you, unless you signed something that said you had absolutely no right to the recording whatsoever, that you could potentially, if it's been released, potentially sign up to PPCA and earn money from that as well.
PPCA is something I know nothing about.
Yeah. So
yeah.
Again,
I know it exists.
Yeah, yeah. And again, PPCA also is obviously ARIA is the one who has, the involvement and the spin-off, I guess, from ARIA is PPCA, which is another collection agency for performance but for the master right for the recording and for every play that it gets. Obviously that makes just a tiny bit of money that you can then earn from
that. It's tricky in our world, right? Because if you think about where our music gets played, it is just on the ABC and it's not even very often.
Mm.
Like if I'm talking about radio airplay.
Mm.
So,
but also
it's
playing,
not like a pop song which is on high rotation.
No.
Like it's never going to make that much money.
No, but also just playing it live. Playing it in a venue.
Yeah.
If you play in the Melbourne Recital Centre or you play in the Sydney Opera House, that makes you money.
Yeah.
You actually earn royalties from that performance. If you've registered it with APRA AMCOS and PPCA, you will make money out of that performance. So it is worth sort of looking into that a bit deeper. And here's where I kind of go for me, there feels like there's a bit of a disconnect, and I'm not sure why, but I feel like there is opportunity. I think there is opportunity. I may be completely wrong, and as I said, I'm still learning. I'm still learning too, Claire, and I'm very conscious of that.
Well, it'll be interesting to see, just because our model is not like pop tunes that are on high rotations and are of a certain length and a certain popularity. Like, it's not, that's not the world that we're living in. We've got to be real about that. And, so it's interesting, though, because, of course, there's certain elements that none of us have ever been taught, so you just don't decide not to worry about, because there's only so many things that you can worry about.
And if
it's not
going to
bring you that much money, then it's kind of not really worth worrying about. We should probably move on, but we should – awesome if AMC would put some sort of a little chat on about it, because I'm sure there's lots of other people who are A, more informed than me, and but would still like to know more, or also less informed than me.
Yeah.
I'm not very well informed with making money from,
And do you know the other thing that's really interesting to me is that there's only maybe a very, very small handful of managers, people who manage artists in this space.
Oh, there's like virtually none.
Yeah.
And they're all
I've come across one.
Like they play classical music.
Yeah.
Most of them.
Yep.
So like I don't have a manager. No. Because it's such a small scene, you know, like you can kind of, you're better off just staying in touch with everyone yourself. Mm. I mean, in Europe you would need a manager.
Mm.
But I don't know, Australia is so small. But also no one wants to manage someone who plays music that doesn't make that much money.
Mm.
Like, again, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's interesting though, isn't it? Because that's the role of a manager, is to find avenues to make it more sustainable. So it's kind of
basket.
it's really interesting for me, because, you know, even in the popular music space, particularly over the last 2 years, it's been absolutely impossible. I mean, without live shows. It really is like a very key place for people to make their money to survive. And for me, making music and making money, the two things shouldn't be mutually exclusive. You can try to have both. I don't think it's a horrible thing to want to wish for.
Oh, to be able to not. And I mean,
survive,
let's be honest,
by your craft.
Like, relying on government subsidies forever is also not a realistic approach.
Well, I don't think it's realistic moving forward. And
no,
I think with everything that's
scary.
Just gone on. Yeah, I really think it's now's the time to look for opportunity. And I think that that's more, it's not the exact art of what happens in popular music and the way that sort of is differentiated by commercial or non-commercial. To me, it's just as much about attitude.
Yeah.
So, you know, knowing that you can make or break the rules, and it's a very, you know, very standard and usual thing in popular music, and particularly for managers and artists, is to look for angles, you know, look for the angles, like where's the opportunity, where's the potential to get my music heard or get their music into something, you know, how can I get music out there en masse to as many people as possible with the hope that they will love it and they will take to it and it will actually affect and hopefully change their lives for the better. So if you can get that exposure, then you have a chance, you know, you have an opportunity. If you can't, then how would you ever know, you know? And so it's about making the connection with audience. And that idea of audience engagement and building audience, I think, is really important.
Well, that's something that we talk about a lot at Ensemble Offspring and also do, I guess, hopefully.
Yeah, you do.
But, yeah, it's a challenge. It's a real challenge, especially when you're performing music. Again, where the difference is with popular music, it's different every time and very different.
Mm.
It's a hard thing to sell because you're selling the unknown, basically.
Mm.
And so you're relying on your audience's thirst for being challenged or for, going into deep water and not knowing what they're going to experience in the most part, which to me is very exciting, and that's what I'm looking for, but I don't think too many people are. So it's about finding the people who are.
Yes.
Or convincing the people who don't think they are that they are.
Oh, well, I think, you know, for me, and this is what I mean by sort of bringing, also bringing art music to the popular music world, it's incredible to me how absolutely magic some of this music I've heard in this particular part of the community, how magic it is, and how many people within that popular music space would actually love it and take to it and actually really grasp it. But I don't think there's been that exposure. I don't think we've had that connection. And, you know, I think we progressively will need to have, you know, it's important that
we just had a great idea.
Educate, you know.
We should start, like, is it Triple R, the Melbourne radio station that's like the community?
There's two big ones, so Triple R and PBS.
Yeah,
would be the two big ones.
Yeah. One of those, and we've got FBI in Sydney.
Yes, which is
and
wonderful.
I love FBI. Mm. But we need to start an art music radio station, a digital stream, and then it can be on like 24-hour just playing that sort of music, and we don't have to wait for the ABC to decide like which time of day they might play a 5-minute piece. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful.
How do you fund that sort of thing? I don't even know.
Well, I don't think you necessarily have to. I mean, it's so easy to do this kind of thing now and just start it. I mean, having said that, then you've got the thing you have to consider are the rights within that as well. But if you're that's something we could look into, Claire.
I think it could be really cool. Like, imagine the amount of extra exposure it could give to Australian composers. Wouldn't just have to be Australian contemporary music, but it could be. And then also audiences. So you could say to, like, your audiences who you're trying to develop, pop on this radio station for a bit and see what you think, and then you know, the concert will probably sound something like that or whatever. I don't know, like, you could imagine it would help a lot of people sort of help to sell their art form
on some but level. Also, for me too, it's interesting, you know, in the popular music space, you've got, you know, obviously the ARIAs and the APRA AMCOS awards, which you've got, you know, and then you've got the Art Music Awards, obviously, and this and
that's part of the tiny dumb awards.
Yeah, but for me there's opportunity and exposure to cross over there. Like, and for me, I know it's important for a community to have its moment together and to be able to sort of come together and really celebrate and support and nurture, you know, particular genres of music.
Well, on that note, very nice to chat.
Yeah, so
we
awesome.
Got a bit bogged down in the kind of rights stuff, but That's all good. Hopefully it's interesting for some people.
Yeah, I hope so too. I really, you know, thank you for asking me to do this and to be a part of it. It's, you know, I feel very honoured.
Oh, don't be silly. No, I was really honoured that you agreed, and this is going to go out soon in our first season, and I'm very excited.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Offcast with Claire Edwards. For more information on the innovative people and musical projects discussed in this episode, take a look at the show notes below. We'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch by emailing admin@ensembleoffspring.com. And if you're interested in supporting The Offcast and the important creative work we do at Ensemble Offspring, you can donate via our website. Keep listening for more conversations with musical mavericks.